KXJZ reports.
The plan, approved by the Bay Area Air Pollution Board, calls for annual fees ranging from $180,000 for a large oil refinery to $1 for a service station. The money, expected to total just over $1 million from 2,500 businesses, would fund the calculation, study, and control of greenhouse gases in the district. Representatives of oil refineries and several business groups oppose the fee, saying it duplicates the state law designed to control global warming gases throughout California. Regulators counter the measure complements efforts by the state's Air Resources Board to reduce global warming emissions. The fee is scheduled to go into effect July 1st. For NPR News, I'm Bob Hensley in Modesto, California.
And I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Vital Projects Fund, supporting the Museum of Modern Art, now showing Take Your Time, Olafur Eliasson. Details at moma.org.
A gift annuity offers benefits to you and WILL, especially when you make it before July 1st. Gift annuities can help by converting stock or other appreciated property or low-interest investments into a high rate of guaranteed lifetime income. The American Council on Gift Annuities sets recommended annuity rates for nonprofit organizations, and its lowered rates effective July 1st. However, there's still time to lock in the current rates, maximizing the income you'll receive for life. It's easy, and the process can be completed through the mail. For more information, contact WILL's Don DeBeard at 217-333-1070. We look forward to talking with you.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Christie Clinic Association, with offices in Champaign, Urbana, Rantoul, Mahomet, Tuscola, and Danville, providing quality health care to the residents of Central Illinois.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In this first hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about Egypt, contemporary Egypt and its politics. And our guest for the program is Ken Cuno. He is Associate Professor of History here at the University of Illinois. His area of specialty is the modern history of the Middle East, particular area of focus is Egypt, and he's been good enough to be with us here many times before, in fact, to talk a little bit about what has been happening in Egypt. And perhaps it's been about a year since we had a conversation like this, and we asked him if he'd be good enough to come back and talk some more, and he said sure, he'd be happy to do that. So we're pleased to have him here. We'll be talking a little bit about politics there, and questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to keep their comments and questions brief so that we can keep our program moving along and get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, questions from listeners are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions, you can give us a call. Well, thanks very much for being here once again.
Thank you for inviting me.
Just as a way of one way of beginning, I thought we could talk a little bit about the current government and the current president, Hosni Mubarak. A little earlier this month, he turned 80. Mm-hmm. He is now serving his fifth consecutive term. If he serves out the full term, that will take us into 2011.
That's right.
And according to what I read, if he serves out his full term, he will have been president longer than Nasser and Sadat combined. So this is a long time for one person to be there. And one of the questions that obviously people think about, I'm sure people think about in Egypt, is what happens after Hosni Mubarak?
Right. Well, you can imagine that for years already there have been references to pharaohs when his name comes up, because the pharaohs were always carried out of office feet first. And remains to be seen if President Mubarak will step down at the next election or not. Yes, of course, all the smart money says that his successor will be his son, Gamal, who is 45 this year, and for some years has held an important and very influential position in the governing National Democratic Party. He's, I think, technically the Deputy Secretary General of the NDP, National Democratic Party. He, by the way, is a businessman by background. He has an MBA from the American University in Cairo, and he's fluent in English. So I suppose from the point of view of Washington, it wouldn't be a terrible thing to have somebody with his background. And if he does succeed his father, of course, he will be the first president since the Republic was created after 1952 and the overthrow of the monarchy. He'll be the first president of the country who does not have a military background, who does not come straight out of the military. That said, he has denied that he's angling for a direct succession. President Mubarak himself has said this is not being fixed. And so the government's official position is that there will be no republarchy, which is a translation of gumlukiya or jumlukiya, which is was a term coined some years ago, which smushes together the Arabic words for republic and monarchy, and was invented after the succession of Bashar al-Assad in Syria, a succession to his father. And some Egyptian commentator said, well, this is Jumlukiya now, and Egypt is next with Gamal. There's a lot of public opposition to this idea, and so the government has said it ain't going to happen. Just like that. what is being done, and I wanted to point this out, is that a constitutional path is being smoothed or prepared for the same thing to happen virtually. And by this I mean that most people expect that President Mubarak will stand down in 2011 and not run again. He would be well over 80 at that point. And at that point, then, the political process would take over, and the National Democratic Party would choose a nominee and put him on the ballot, probably with other candidates from the smaller parties. And whoever that nominee is would have an overwhelming likelihood of being elected. And Gamal is very, very well positioned to become that nominee. Also, if the president, for some reason, dies in office, there would be an his prime minister would succeed him constitutionally because there's no vice president. But then there would be elections arranged within a year. And again, the same thing. Gamal is in the best position to be the NDP's nominee. Now, over the past 2 years, also the Mubarak government has put through a number of measures to make this more likely and also to make it more unlikely that any of the opposition parties or the Muslim Brotherhood, which technically is not a party, would manage to field a candidate in the presidential elections who might possibly prove some competition. They've done this by constitutionally reworking process of elections. In 2005, of course, for the first time, the Constitution was amended to allow multi-candidate elections for president, but it was the amended section of the Constitution said, well, you have to the candidate has to be nominated by a recognized political party, number one, and further, they have to have at least one seat in parliament. Okay, so the Muslim Brotherhood is not a recognized political party. It's still technically an illegal organization. It's been running successfully in the past, and especially in 2005, been successful in running candidates as independents for the parliament. And this is how they ended up with about a fifth of the parliamentary deputies in 2005, but they aren't a recognized political party. Well, the Constitution, as amended last year, in another spate of amendments, which analysts see as intended to solidify the regime's control and the succession. In spring of 2007, a new amendment restated this idea that you've got to have a nomination from one recognized political party with at least one seat in the parliament, or alternatively, independents, if they can get the signatures of something like 140 elected local officials around the country, and they have to be distributed in a certain way, province by province, then they can get themselves on the ballot as independents. And here comes the significance of the elections last month, which I'm sure most of our listeners aren't aware of, that Egypt had local, sometimes called municipal elections, in April, and the government did its utmost to disqualify independent candidates who were known to be linked with the Muslim Brotherhood. Well over 1,000 candidates were disqualified, to the point where sorry, it was 10,000 were disqualified, to the point where the Muslim Brotherhood ended up boycotting the elections because only about 20 of their candidates were actually approved to run. And similar harassment and limitations were put on the opposition parties, the secular opposition parties, such that NDP candidates running, mostly running unopposed, ended up with an estimated 90% to 95% of the seats in these local councils. So that, in a sense, effectively forecloses the possibility that an independent candidate will be nominated in 2011 to run for the presidency.
So we still, in spite of the fact that the government would say, well, we've made changes to the process to open things up so it make it possible for other parties to contest on all levels and even at the presidential level, the fact is that they put so many qualifications on who can run and what parties can run that In effect, we've still got a one-party state.
You have to look at the fine print. And our media are not good at doing that. The Egyptian state-controlled media certainly aren't about to help you do that. So you have to look here and there for these details. Even the decision to permit multi-candidate presidential election was announced and then ratified in early 2005, but I think, as I pointed out a year ago, the period for voter registration, it's a narrow window of about 3 or 4 months in the previous fall. So in other words, to vote in those presidential elections in 2005, you would have had to have the foresight to register to vote in the fall of 2004 before the multi-candidate reform was announced. And of course, nobody had an incentive to register. Turnout is abysmally low in all these elections because everybody knows the results. So the timing is important, too, that these reforms, these electoral reforms in particular, are always announced after the beginning of the year in a given year. So yes, the other thing is that the kind of political reforms, and there was an opening up and a little bit more tolerance of dissent. You know, it was highly unusual that starting in 2004, the government permitted demonstrations in downtown Cairo by an organization called Kifaya, which means enough, exclamation point in Arabic, which was largely a middle-class organization, not an official political party, who were simply saying, okay, President Mubarak should not stand for another term. We've had enough. We want to have some opening up of the system, democracy. And this was tolerated, probably because of the pressure coming from the Bush administration on over the issue of democracy and allowing dissent and this sort of thing. But the window closed with a bang at the end of 2005 or beginning of 2006, you might say, with the Muslim Brotherhood throwing a scare into the regime by winning all those seats, still a minority of seats in 2005. And then unanticipedly, Hamas won the Palestinian legislative elections in January of 2006, and then the Egyptians could turn to the Americans and say, okay, you want that? Sure, we'll democratize, but you'll have to pick up the pieces. And so the Americans fell silent, basically, as the Egyptians began to rework the system, and they threw into jail the leading opponent in the presidential election, Ayman Nour, who still is in jail on voter fraud charges and so forth.
Is there any party other than the Muslim Brotherhood that would be in a position to pose a significant electoral challenge to the ruling party?
Not at the moment. Potentially down the road, I mean, one can imagine possibly the Waft party, which is the descendant of the former leading political party in Egypt between 1924 and 1952. The old Waft, the pre-52 Waft, won every fair election. There was an extremely popular party with strong nationalist credentials. And it was revived in 1978 when President Sadat began to open up the system to more competitive politics. But it hasn't made much. It hasn't gotten much traction, to put it that way. For a time, it looked like it was going to go somewhere, but basically, it's discredited itself, I guess you could say. It's internally, it isn't Democrat. None of these opposition political parties are Democratic internally in the way they operate. They don't have a Democratic culture, is the best way I can put it. That's a problem. The other thing is that the WAFT party, as a largely secular liberal party, and also another party called the Tagumaa Party, which is an acronym for a lengthy name I forget exactly, but it's the left-wing party, includes some Marxists. Those two have allowed themselves to come under, you might say, the protective wing of the government, which has been suppressing the Muslim Brotherhood. In other words, they see themselves benefiting if the Brotherhood and its independent candidates are suppressed. This is widely perceived. This discredits them.
Our guest, let me just introduce very quickly for this hour of Focus 580, is Ken Cuno. He is Associate Professor of History at the University of Illinois, specialist in the modern history of the Middle East, particularly in Egypt, and that's what we're talking about here this morning. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, maybe for a moment we turn away from politics, although this is not completely turning away from politics, and talk about economic issues and talk about what life is like for your average Egyptian. And certainly there has been coverage of this in the Western media recently. It's one of those places where there has been a lot of unrest and demonstrations around the cost of food. One of the things that that you read is that there are significant numbers of Egyptians that are living in poverty or near poverty. Mm-hmm. And so for a lot of people, just putting food on the table, this is a big issue.
Yeah. About 20% live below the poverty line, according to the standard measure. And the poverty line in Egypt is $2 per day per capita, to give you an idea. And then another 15% or so are said to be hovering just above, you know, just barely hanging on above the poverty line. It's a country that has a mass, you know, of poor people in it. They're all working poor because the social insurance system isn't sufficient. So when you read also about unemployment, it's about 20%, we're told, structural unemployment in the country. You have to realize that the unemployed are doing things to make money in the so-called informal sector, which is that's the sector of the economy that's not accounted for by the government in its economic censuses for one reason or another. The gray economy, I guess we would call it here. But in other words, people are working their butts off just to keep their families, keep their heads above water, so to speak, economically. And this is something that we could see from having lived there for years and years. We came here to the University of Illinois in 1990 from Egypt. I was a professor at the American University in Cairo, and I had spent most of the 1980s there, eight of the previous 11 years there. And the interesting thing is that every time we've gone back since that time, we always say, you know, well, how are things? And people say, worse. You know, they're always worse than they were before. And a lot of that has to do with the economy, not with politics. I mean, the economy and economic conditions, the cost of food is number one for people. In the past year, I mean, people here have noticed inflation in food prices, which is partly, well, there's lots of reasons, but a lot of it has to do with the price of oil. Others has to do with maybe biofuels and whatnot. But the point is that I've noticed it at the grocery store, and I don't look for this sort of thing. It's really hurting people in Egypt. That, along with the, now it's been 30-plus years of structural readjustment or privatization of the old socialist economy, and that may well be necessary from an economist's point of view for growth, but not enough has been done to cushion the impact on the average person. The average family, which had been surviving in part due to a system of subsidies of basic commodities. So the subsidy system has largely gone by the wayside, although a few things are still subsidized. It causes shortages now. A lot of families don't consume meat except on holidays. And it's one thing to choose to be a vegetarian when you've got all kinds of good stuff to go, you know, stores to go to and buy all kinds of nice stuff. It's another thing in a culture where meat indicates wealth. I mean, there are novels, short stories you can go to where the way a wealthy person is portrayed in the eyes of a poor person is the food on the table, the meat on the table. That indicates wealth. According to what I've seen, there's been a real spate of inflation over the past 2 years. A couple months ago, it was running at about 13 to 15%, depending upon which source you go to. And there have been strikes over pay, you know, cost of living. People, workers, some of them, especially in the public sector, when some of these factories are still in the public sector, demanding effectively cost of living increases. Actually, at the beginning of this month, after the April elections, President Mubarak came forward and announced with a lot of fanfare that there would be a 30% pay raise for public sector employees in response to the labor unrest and some violent clashes with police that this had caused in the previous month. And then a few days later, he left it to his minions to announce that the way they're going to pay for this is by raising the price of fuel and raising the tax on cigarettes as well. Raising the price on fuel is a bit more dire because, again, it affects everyone, even if you don't drive. Everything, is, including food, is transported by motor vehicle these days. So, you know, it's a rather dire situation, but people don't have quite the margin that we do when costs go up.
Yeah. One could imagine that this would be a recipe for a great, even more significant social unrest than has been seen in Egypt. At the same time, if it's a place where the government has so much control and the ability to quash protest, then it doesn't really seem that there's very much for much of any place for people to go in terms of trying to register their not just register their unhappiness with the government, but in fact do anything to make things any different.
Yeah, this is the concern is exactly that there will be the protests so far, including the labor actions, have reached only a certain level of organization, best way I can put it. But beyond sort of bread and butter issues, they haven't gone. And the question is, if things continue to be dire like this, there continues to be this kind of unrest at the same time that the government is closing off avenues of legitimate political participation, in particular aimed at the Muslim Brotherhood, marginalizing them, which had been, by all indications, trying to work itself into legitimate political activity. By closing off those avenues, one wonders if eventually then somebody might decide to take a more radical approach. This is the concern, but it's something that's very below the radar, it seems, at least in our national discourse, where of course, we're debating now whether we should talk or not talk, or whether it's Munich in 1938 or not.
Yeah. I'm curious to make some comparisons between the conditions for people in Egypt, and if you look at other places, say in the Middle East, other places where there are not wars going on, Syria, Jordan, the Gulf states, to look at how people are doing elsewhere, and then look at how people in Egypt are doing. How do they compare?
Well, I can give you a firsthand impression, but going back to when I was a student in 1979, and I was a language student in Egypt, my first experience in the Middle East there. And I'd been in Egypt for 3 or 4 months, and we had our August break, and so I went with a couple of friends to Beirut. There was a ceasefire at the time, so it was pretty safe, and was going around. And some friends took us up into the mountains, and we had a nice picnic lunch, and I remarked on how prosperous Lebanon appeared to me to be, in spite of several years of warfare at that point. And my friends, both Lebanese and Americans resident in Lebanon, were astonished, and they said, "This is one of the poorest areas. You didn't notice, you know, of Lebanon. I said, well, I've just come from Egypt. I said, oh, okay. You know, that explains it. It is a very poor country. And you see it. I guess you become accustomed to seeing it, but the poverty is definitely there. And I think by comparison with most Arab countries, it would, you know, appear that way. The later in the year, over the winter, I went to Sudan, and I had the opposite experience. I mean, Sudan is a country, and even back in 1980 was a country where things were abysmally worse than in Egypt in terms of the levels of poverty. So it is a relative thing. People who've been to India as well as Egypt tell me that you know, Egypt doesn't have poverty like India does. So there you are.
We are at our midpoint here. We'll continue, of course, to talk with our guest, Ken Cuno. He is Associate Professor of History at the University of Illinois. He's a specialist in the history of the modern Middle East, and his main area of interest is Egypt, contemporary Egypt. He's Associate Professor of History here at U of I. And questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Does Egypt and the Egyptian government continue to play some kind of significant role in trying to address the Israeli-Palestinian mm-hmm. conflict?
Very much so. A cynic would say, but not incorrectly, that this is one way that the Mubarak regime ingratiates themselves with Washington so as to get the pressure on them to democratize, lightened up. But Egypt also has a very strong interest in seeing progress toward a political settlement and a cooling down of passions on the Israeli-Palestinian front. After all, it's right next door. And Gaza is now on the, you know, in between Egypt and Israel physically. And Hamas is the Muslim Brotherhood. It's the Palestinian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood, autonomous as far as anyone knows. But Egypt really, the Mubarak regime really doesn't want to see Hamas become all that successful. Even, I would venture, even a tamed-down version of Hamas that would participate peacefully in electoral process, this sort of thing, because that's exactly what the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood is trying to do. Nevertheless, they're realists. Unlike the Americans, they're actually in contact with Hamas on a regular basis and the other Palestinians. And they see, I think they see the best way forward would be to try to reconcile the two sides of the Palestinian split, Fatah, led by Mahmoud Abbas, in the West Bank. They're not in control of the West Bank, but they are in the West Bank, and Hamas, which is in control, sort of in control of Gaza, because nothing really much can be accomplished without a coherent Palestinian political force or group, whatever you want to call it, to represent the Palestinian side.
Mm-hmm. I just, you wonder when you think about how it is the people in the government in Egypt and the ruling party think, and that they would, you can imagine them saying, well, they don't like the Muslim Brotherhood and they don't really want to have an organized and coherent and effective challenge to their political party, both perhaps for ideological reasons and simply because they want to continue in power. On the same time, though, you might imagine someone saying, but if we don't create some option, some way for there to be some kind of viable opposition that we can deal with, there's going to be an opposition that we can't. I mean, that there, as you said before, that then what you're doing is you're opening the door to an even more in the way that the government would look at it, an even more radical, mm-hmm. threatening kind of opposition that wouldn't just oppose you at the polls, but that could indeed take violent means as the way of their expressing their opposition. You would think they'd say, well, it would make sense for us to have an opposition that we could deal with rather than one that we can't.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, they of course, their goal, as far as I can tell, is to keep themselves in power. So so creating a viable opposition that you can deal with is not something you'd want to do in that situation. And It has to be pointed out that they've been very successful in defeating radical opponents, at least in the recent past. The Jamaa Islamiyah were largely defeated by 1997 and had to declare a ceasefire. And before that, the other jihadist groups that arose in the 70s and 80s. By the way, one of the people who escaped their clutches and who was involved in the organization that assassinated President Sadat is Ayman al-Zawahiri, who's the number two man in al-Qaeda. He and remnants of his Egyptian jihad organization made it out and eventually to Afghanistan and Pakistan. But they have successfully suppressed the radical opposition, which has been Islamist in the 80s and 90s, partly, though, due to the, you might say, the strategic incompetence of those groups, who have a peculiar had a peculiar strategy that they thought they derived from the example of the Prophet Muhammad, and they probably should have been reading Lenin instead. But conditions may just not be right for a radical movement of that sort. I think it maybe makes more sense to think in terms of within the established political system what might conceivably happen down the road. One option that you hinted at earlier, David, was the idea of one of these mainline recognized political parties actually becoming a viable force, and perhaps the WAFT would or somebody else would, it's hard to say, under a younger, newer leadership. Or another possibility is devolution within the ruling NDP itself. There is a great deal of competition in the lower levels between individuals for the right to run in these elections as the official designated NDP candidate. They've got far more potential candidates than they can actually deal with. So oftentimes you have independents running, though, who have declared publicly that they will join the NDP if elected, if they're defeating the regular NDP candidate. And that sometimes happens. The problem is that so far, at least, the reason there is this competition is because they see the NDP as a source of benefits to themselves, their families, their cliques, rather than this reflecting maybe different tendencies within the NDP. But the NDP is such a huge and sprawling organization. It is possible that a group might arise in it and split off and form a viable party. It's hard to say.
Right. Let's talk with someone who is listening here, someone here in Champaign County where we are in line number one. Hello.
Hi. I have something about Lebanon, but maybe something on Egypt as well. And that's, I remember when some round of prior elections were going ahead, and I think I heard on the BBC that part of the nominating process was that you had to have a certain number of government signatures of government officials. A very bizarre, I mean, our primaries are pretty strange, but to actually, it's a way of culling the group, and I don't even know how any real opposition forces get on at all, except for perhaps some division inside the government. But was that a proper characterization? Another thing on
Yes.
Another thing on Egypt. I just heard about some massive show trial, not of Islamists, but of gays or something. And I'm wondering whether Mubarak's government is trying to use the social issues in a wedge way. It's sort of identified with the West as modernizing, et cetera, all those tropes. But they had some kind of massive show trial.
Unless there's something that happened very, very recently I'm not aware of, this was going back maybe 2 or 3 years. There were some very high-profile arrests. In Cairo, there were some houseboats on the Nile that were known to be places where gays would get together, and it was tolerated but not spoken about publicly. Arrests were made, I don't remember exactly the full results of it, but it was understood at the time that this was a nifty way to distract people's attention from, more witty political things, with the government sort of presenting itself as guardian of public morals. So you're right. That has gone on.
Okay. I think that is the incident. This was about a recent film, and it's got a fairly broad scope of the whole Islamic world. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. On Lebanon, the way it's characterized is the opposition is just Hezbollah, doesn't count Hamal, and doesn't count you know, the Maronites, the Aoun faction. I mean, no one ever, I mean, and the fact that there hasn't been, for a great purpose, there hasn't been a census. So the fraud of calling anything that's confessional and is designated like that a democracy is so huge that I don't know how it stands. But I don't know if you want to explain some of that, but why is Aoun's faction thrown in with Hezbollah?
Lebanon, well, it's another kettle of fish. My understanding about Michel Aoun is that, and you're right, he is a Christian, a former general, I think. This was an opportunistic move to align his faction with Hezbollah. It has nothing to do with ideology, or at most has to do with the people he doesn't like on the other side. Lebanese politics oftentimes has been this coalition making between different confessional groups. And I think that, I mean, you're correct that our media are incapable of seeing things except in very simplistic, cartoonish ways. So when they find a framework that they like, you know, opposition, Syrian-supported opposition versus American-supported government, then that's nice and neat, and it kind of works for them. But it doesn't really explain very much of what's going on.
Well, it's very useful, though, for the broader war on terror, et cetera, et cetera. But so who is Aoun? This latest imbroglio happened. Some of the Amal was actually in the forefront of it, at least in some of the incidents I heard, which is the other Shiite faction, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So the simplification is not just... It's a very useful simplification because it fits in this broader war that they want to get on here. Anyway, as far as Egypt's role in Gaza, I still can't get over the barrier being taken down, and actually so little ramifications after the fact. In the Arab world, it must have been seen as a metaphor for the whole wall.
Well, the barrier was taken down, or was knocked down, or blown up. I don't remember exactly, by Hamas on their side. This is the barrier between Egypt and the Gaza Strip for the other listeners. The Egyptians then replaced it after some days. I don't remember what the interval was, but they allowed people to come through to shop. Some of them were shopping for guns, and then they were then they put the wall back up. Because this has to do with the agreement that was made with the Israelis. And again, as I said before, the Egyptians have an interest in containing Hamas.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with our guest, Ken Cuno. He's Associate Professor of History at the University of Illinois, is an historian of the modern Middle East, Egypt particularly, and that's what we've been mostly talking about here, is recent events in Egypt. If you have questions, you can call us 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Something else I know that you would like to talk a little bit about, and when we talk about what's happening in the Middle East and the societies in the Middle East, there are people who are particularly interested in the position of women and the issue of women's rights. And you say that, in fact, if you're looking for something that you could say was a positive development in Egypt, it would be in that area.
Yeah, this is one of the ways in which this story is a rather complicated one, because I suppose in America we tend to sort of lump all progressive things together, democratization and advance of women and so forth and so on. In fact, what I was describing earlier was the government kind of moving back away from the brink of permitting meaningful participation in competitive politics by opposition organizations. At the same time, though, they've been moving very resolutely, I would say, forward over the past decade or so, in advancing women's rights and also in advancing the position of women. Most recently, I think it was a year ago or sometime within the past year, 30 women were appointed to judgeships, to the judiciary, which was something new. The year before, 1 or 2 years before that, President Mubarak made a big splash by appointing the first woman ever to the judiciary and placing her on the Supreme Constitutional Court. So it would be a situation like if in this country, if we had no women judges at all, and President Bush decided to knock things loose by putting, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the Supreme Court or Sandra Day O'Connor as the first judge in the entire country. That's what happened in Egypt. Mm. Going back about 3 years, then 1 or 2 years ago, the first 30 women jurists were put on the courts. And incidentally, that indicates that there were at least that many qualified women jurists who were attorneys or professors in law schools who could serve in that capacity. They've also been appointing, I don't know what number, but a certain number of women. And this is apparently they're committed to ongoing now doing this, appointing female public prosecutors, because a lot of the judges are drawn from the ranks of the public prosecutors, and the absence of women in those ranks had been a problem in the past that had been cited in terms of finding, you know, qualified women. So that's symbolically, that's a major advance, I would say. And down the road, it will be substantively, too, when it comes to interpreting the law. I don't know how many of these women are actually serving in family courts. It's a complicated system, but from my studies of the workings of family law, and when I referred to earlier to the advances in women's rights, a lot of this has to do with the position of women, legally speaking, within the family, including in the last decade their expanded ability to petition a court for a divorce in spite of their husband's opposition to the divorce. And but, of course, it's one thing to revise the statute law. It's another thing to get a judge to interpret it properly, and there have been some complaints about this. So when you move women up into positions of authority in the judiciary or authority anywhere else, you begin to change slowly, the climate, the culture of the entire place. And so this will have a long-term effect. Now, of course, Egypt lagged behind some other countries in appointing women judges, in particular Turkey, which goes way, way back to the 1950s or earlier, having women judges, but better late than never. This commitment and this rather steady development of expanded opportunities for women and women's rights seems to have two points of origin. One is grassroots activism by Egyptian lawyers, in particular women lawyers, who are not seeking a name for themselves, which is why they're not well known over here. They don't get interviewed by the New York Times. They don't write books that are translated. They simply plug away. And most importantly, they've developed a very effective method of dealing with cultural conservatives who say that you can't change this because this is God's law and this is the way it was meant. And what they do is they actually go to the Islamic experts in the country and get them to say, well, actually, no, the current law reflects more custom and actually Islam permits us to do it this new way. And so it gets the imprimatur of the highest religious authorities in the country. The other factor behind these changes is the president's wife, Suzanne Mubarak, who has effectively and, again, not very publicly supported these measures. So, and this is in strong contrast to her predecessor, Jihan Sadat, who was lionized in the West and interviewed by Barbara Walters and everybody else as a great feminist, and of course got the nationalism of the Egyptians up, and she wasn't able to make much headway. Suzanne Mubarak has learned from that example and has been much more effective in promoting these reforms.
Mm-hmm. Well, one other thing that I think is interesting as well, and no doubt is also one thing that probably hadn't gotten a lot of coverage in the mainstream Western media, has to do with religious freedom. And this is, and in a way this surprises me, and that is apparently traditionally the only religions that were officially recognized were Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, mm-hmm. and apparently now they have decided that they were going to officially recognize Baha'is, mm-hmm. which surprises me given the way I would think a lot of Muslims think about the Baha'i faith.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, the Baha'i faith, which I think most Americans who know anything about it think of it as a very nice, liberal faith, and Baha'is, according to their religion, are not supposed to be politically active, so one can't imagine them oppressing anyone. But historically, the Baha'i faith evolved out of a movement within Shi'i Islam in Iran in the 1840s, and it had, for a time, its predecessor version was a revolutionary movement that engaged in some violence. Excuse me. I have a bit of a cough here. But they went on their current pacifist direction way back in the middle of the 19th century. But having evolved out of Islam and proclaiming that there are prophets after the Prophet Muhammad, of course, gets them technically put in the box of heretics. So this is why Muslims who know something about the history of the Baha'i faith oftentimes oppose them on the grounds of heresy. There's a second and sort of accidental reason why some Muslims don't like Baha'is, and that is because the leader of the Baha'i faith, after whose name the faith comes, Baha'u'llah, who lived in the 19th century, later 19th century, was exiled by the Ottoman Sultan to Haifa, which is now in Israel, and because he was put in exile there as a way of sort of containing him and keeping him out of trouble, the World Baha'i Center was established in Haifa long before the State of Israel, but it's still there. And so some Arab nationalists and some Muslims will point to what they imagine is a connection between the Baha'i faith and Zionism. And actually, I have actually seen anti-Semitic tropes of the sort, of the conspiracy sort, used in discussing Baha'is in Arabic. So why in Egypt? Have they lightened up on them? Well, first of all, it's a tiny, tiny minority. They're all middle class, so they're utterly innocuous, and they're not a threat to anybody at all. Secondly, I think that you can compare this situation maybe to the women's rights discourse that I was discussing earlier, that somehow more rights for religious minorities like the Baha'is and in advance of women's rights have been sort of depoliticized, you might say. In other words, these issues are not part of the debates or discourse going on between the Muslim Brotherhood in the government or the opposition parties in the government or the labor protests in the government. Those are more kind of issues of political participation or bread-and-butter economic issues. But the opponents of the forthright opponents of the government are not slamming them over minority religious rights or over women's rights. Rather, women's rights, for a century at least, has been part of the national narrative, the advance of the nation and the independence of the nation and the modernization of the nation have been strongly linked with a narrative of women's advance and women's emancipation, as they call it. And so this is simply seen as fulfilling, if you will, the promise of the nation, in a way perhaps the history of the franchise, civil rights, and extending the franchise to racial minorities, and before that to women, and before that to non-property owning men, is kind of, in American textbooks, is kind of presented as kind of the unfolding of American democracy and the fulfillment of the promise of the Declaration and that sort of thing. Likewise, being nice to this tiny minority of innocuous people, the Baha'is, also fits very well with Egyptians' notions about themselves as basically decent, nice, tolerant people.
We have one more caller here. Oh, well, we had. I'm sorry. Perhaps we kept them waiting too long. If you'd like to call back very quickly, we can get you on here. And certainly we would take at least one more call here. We just do have about 2 minutes left in this part of the show with our guest, Ken Cuno. He's an associate professor of history here at the University of Illinois. I'm opening up a subject that's worthy of a more discussion, but something that I have been thinking about here as I've been listening to you. If one is concerned about there being a viable political opposition to any particular regime in the Middle East, Egypt, or elsewhere, would one have to be willing to accept an Islamist party as being that opposition, because that's pretty much where the viable opposition is?
Right now in Egypt, yes. And that's probably true of most parts of the Muslim Middle East. I don't see why not. The Turkish example, and I grant you, Turkey is a very unusual place. It's not like most of the other Middle Eastern countries, but Turkey at least gives us an example of a Islamist party, the Justice and Welfare Party, or AKP, that seems to have turned itself into something akin to, let's say, the social democratic parties that used to be influential in European politics or Latin American politics. In other words, a party that has, shall we say, an Islamic reference point, but that is not pushing necessarily an Islamist agenda. That's the Turkish party I'm referring to. And to bring it back to Egypt, it's interesting that the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt in recent years has been emulating some of its analogs in North Africa by referring to itself as not an Islamist party, but an organization that works within an so-called an Islamic frame of reference, as a way of sort of softening their Islamist image and perhaps positioning themselves to acquire legal standing as a political party by saying, well, I should mention that the Egyptian constitution for a long, long time has prohibited political parties from being formed on a religious basis. So you can't have a Christian party, you can't have a Muslim party, that sort of thing. So by referring to themselves as an organization that operates within an Islamic framework, that's softening it and maybe would allow themselves to present themselves as kind of a Muslim democratic party, like an analog of Christian democratic party. The constitutional amendments of a year ago foreclose that option. And it prohibits, one of the amendments prohibits not only the formation of a religious-based political party, but any political parties within an Islamic or within a religious framework, literally borrowing that language. So they've closed off that avenue as well.
Well, I think at that point we're going to have to finish with our thanks to our guest, Kenneth Cuno. He is Associate Professor of History at the University of Illinois. His special area of interest is the modern Middle East and Egypt particularly. He's been here before to talk, and we appreciate you giving us
some
time. Thank
you. I enjoyed it.
Programming here on WILL is made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, featuring locally grown and organic produce, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar, and bulk foods department. Strawberry Fields also offers natural vitamins, health and beauty products, household cleaning products, pet foods, and an in-store nutritionist to answer your questions about healthy eating. Coming up a little bit later today, we'll have the Afternoon Magazine. Show gets underway at noon today with usual mix of news and features and other things. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour, they will be repeating a program from the Afternoon Magazine archives, a conversation that Celeste Quinn had with Tricia Tunstall. She is a writer, teacher, and musician, and this is a conversation about a book that she wrote titled Note by Note, A Celebration of the Piano Lesson. So if you did not hear that first time around, you'll have the opportunity in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine today. And in fact, if you'd like to go back and catch up on some programs from the Afternoon Magazine or Focus 580 you might have missed, go to our web archive. It's WILL, that's will.illinois.edu, and it will tell you everything that you need to know. In the next part of this show, we'll be talking about the militarization of space, and our guest for the program is Mike Moore. He is the author of a book entitled Twilight War, The Folly of U.S. Space Dominance. So that's up in the next hour. Right now, though, we'll take a break, as we usually do, for some news and an update on the market, so please stay tuned.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session. We're seeing quite a bit of softer undertones in the marketplace. Off of the opening bell, we had a little bit of a strong opening on the coattails of higher crude oil prices. Crude oil prices making new contract highs again today, but we have since backed off of that at mid-session. Let's go ahead and look at the particulars, and as we do that, we'll begin in Kansas City, where in the July contract we're now trading 807.5, down 22.5, September 819.5, down 21.5, July wheat 758 down 20, September 781 down 12, December 794 down 20, July corn $6 down 7.25, September 613 down 6.75, December 627 down 6.5, March of 2009 640.5 down 5.75. July beans 13.45 down 4, August 13.51 down 1.5, September 13.57 up 4.5, November 13.43 down 12. July soybean meal 3.32 down 50, July soybean oil 62.55 down 70. June live cattle 95 up 37.5, May feeders 107.95 down 10.